for several months, I have been reviewing first the Four Noble Truths, and then got to the Noble Eightfold Path, and then got to Right Mindfulness, and then got to the Satipatthana, which is the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, which is really what Right Mindfulness is, and then got to the what are called the Chittasikas, the mind conditioning elements. We took several meetings for that. And then for the last three meetings, I've talked about the seven awakening factors. And tonight I'm going to talk about the process of awakening, or what is also called the progressions of insight. Now, the progressions of insight are not really, they are mentioned in the Pali Canon, the early teachings of Buddhism, but they weren't really fully developed for several centuries after the life of the Buddha. And they were pretty much established through a very extensive text called the Visuddhimagga, which was composed by a monk named Buddhaghosa, who lived in the 5th century of the Common Era in Sri Lanka. And that's kind of the prime reference for Theravada Buddhism. Now, these seven stages or progressions of insight are pretty much only found in the Theravadan tradition. I want to be really clear about that, that this is not meant to be the definitive description of the process of awakening. It's one of several modalities that were developed in Theravada Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism, and Vajrayana Buddhism. So that's an important thing to understand. But most of my studies and practice has been in the Theravadan realm, and most particularly in what's called Western Vipassana or secular Buddhism. I find this description of the stages of purification to be really useful, because they provide markers, stages, or you could even say symptoms of various states of mind that are indicative that one's attention and self-regulation is becoming more and more enhanced. Now, I mentioned that I spent three meetings talking about the seven awakening factors, and I just want to bring them in the beginning here just to kind of set the stage for talking about the stages of purification or awakening. The awakening factors are qualities of attention that are unhindered, and they represent skill sets in regards to the ability to pay attention. And those skill sets become more and more integrated, more and more recognizable, and more potent in terms of not just setting aside the hindrances. In fact, setting aside the hindrances is what really empowers them, but really understanding at deeper and more profound levels what are called the three characteristics, core principles of Buddhism. Anicca, which is the transient nature of our subjective experience. Anatta, which is the absence of an enduring autonomous self. And dukkha. And dukkha is basically the inherent insecurity and instability and dissatisfaction that comes about as a result of craving and clinging. And craving is a kind of a physiological urgency, and clinging is a mental fascination, if you will. Thoughts occur because that's what the brain does. You know, I've said this so many times, and I think it's important to keep reiterating it. The function of the heart is to move blood around the body. The function of the lungs is to move gases into the body and out of the body. Function of this digestive tract is to take in food and transform it into energy and other nutritive elements. And the function of the brain is to regulate those activities, but also to think. So this process of awakening is not about eliminating thinking. It's about understanding that thinking is just a phenomenon of nature. It isn't a self. It's not certain. It's useful socially, functionally, it's useful. But spiritually, it's important to be able to, in a sense, see through the what seems to be the certainty of thoughts, to see them as just more or less useful fabrications. Just like, you know, heartbeat is a useful fabrication and digestion is a useful fabrication. That's a very important part of this process of awakening. Because after all, you know, the Buddha experienced nirvana, the unconditioned, which is really the goal of this process of awakening that I'll be reviewing tonight. But, you know, after he had that profound transformative experience, he functioned very well socially. Very articulate, very wise, very clever in his ability to negotiate the development of a community that's one of the oldest religious communities in the history of the world. So I want to make that clear. This process of awakening is not meant to wipe out thinking or feeling. It's to have a whole different perspective on the appropriate function of these different characteristics. So I'm going to rattle off the stages quickly, and then I'm going to go through them item by item. First one is purification of conduct. Next one's purification of mind, purification of view, purification by overcoming doubt, purification by knowledge and vision of what is path and not path, purification by knowledge and vision of the course of practice. Now, that last one has a kind of a subset to it. The first is knowledge of contemplation of rise and fall. Then the next is contemplation of dissolution. Knowledge of appearance as terror. Knowledge of contemplation of danger. Knowledge of contemplation of dispassion. Knowledge of desire for deliverance. Knowledge of contemplation of reflection. Knowledge of equanimity about formations. And conformity knowledge. And purification by knowledge and vision. Then that has a subset. Change of lineage, first path and fruit, second path and fruit, third path and fruit, fourth path and fruit. So change of lineage is the first experience that one has of awakening. Now, I'm not going to really dive into those last categories. I don't think they're relevant to this review. But they constitute what is understood in Theravada Buddhism, Buddhist psychology, as different levels of total liberation from anicca, dukkha, and anatta, particularly the dukkha part. Okay. Now, first one is purification of virtue. And in terms of the Noble Eightfold Path, this is right speech, right action, right livelihood. Now, I recharacterize that third category as, I would call it, right lifestyle, or even wholesome lifestyle. Back when this system was compiled, people generally lived in a much less complex and dynamic culture than what we live in today. And our obligation as a generation, as a cohort of humanity on the planet right now, is to review, study this ancient wisdom and reformulate it in ways that are more useful in terms of the process of awakening. Not to dismiss awakening, but to use maybe different terminology or different understandings of it. And I'm going to say that, you know, what I'm going to be talking about tonight, it's my understanding. I have not experienced awakening. I've experienced some of these stages, some of these purifications, and I'll share with you, you know, my experience. But I think I just want to convey the concepts to you as we go forward. So, virtue, it basically is cultivating a lifestyle that has some kind of integrity. When I talk about integrity, I'm not just talking about being honest. That's part of right speech. But I'm talking about a well-integrated lifestyle. I was talking to someone today whose lifestyle, is, we talked about this, I described it as a long, slow train wreck. And of course, I went through a period of that, like that, in my life before I started practicing Buddhism and when I first began practicing Buddhism. But, you know, overstressed by work, dysfunctional relationship dynamics. This person actually has periodic problems with what we call binge drinking and so forth and so on. This does not provide a foundation or a basis for process of awakening. So an integrated lifestyle is one that is still functional, still in a sense pays the bills, but also is supportive of a healthy body, healthy relationships, healthy management of your, what you have, your possessions, your finances, and also, I believe, relationship to the world at large and to the environment. So, to me, that's part of what a virtuous life is. Now, if that's all I can achieve with my years, 40 plus years of meditation practice, mindfulness meditation practice, I'm good with that. I'm good with that. So I'm now going to be talking about spiritual attainments, which I also find very fascinating. I've been interested in this since way before I started practicing Buddhism. Okay. Next one, purification of the mind. This is another aggregate of the Eightfold Path. Right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Now, those are reflected, you know, in terms of their functionality with the seven awakening factors that I reviewed at the beginning of the talk. You know, right effort basically is the energy awakening factor. Did I mention the awakening factors? It's mindfulness, investigation of mental phenomena, energy manifested as persistent right effort, part of the Eightfold Path, joy, which really is, in this case, enthusiastic interest in whatever is coming into consciousness. When I say enthusiastic, I don't mean brimming over with desire. I mean, there's a quality of diligence and conscientiousness in paying attention that I really enjoy, the joy awakening factor. It's something that I really value about my practice and about going on retreats. Tranquility awakening factor and concentration or unification awakening factor and the equanimity and balance awakening factor. So all of those are integrated and mutually reinforcing. That's what the purification of the mind part is. Its first manifestation is the setting aside of the five hindrances. Now, five hindrances represent disturbances or distortions in how the mind operates. Desire, aversion, and ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and skeptical doubt. So, as the mind becomes more stable in its focus and less reactive to emotions, more balanced, that's what purification of the mind is about. Now, all that's doing is sort of clearing the decks for deeper insight, deeper Vipassana practice. And it really sets the stage for Vipassana. Because, you know, Vipassana is basically insight into three characteristics, anicca, dukkha, and anatta. That's what that practice involves. So the next stage is purification of view. And it's also called knowledge of nama rupa. Now, nama is how the mind creates meaning in regards to rupa. And rupa is inhabiting a body. You know, light and the processes that turn it into vision. Sound and the processes that turn that into hearing. Chemicals in the air and the processes that turn that into smelling. Chemicals in food that turn it into tasting. And the systemic operation of the body. Feelings of pressure, pain, movement, fatigue, so forth and so on. So, nama rupa is an important distinction to make. Now, just contemplate this as I'm talking about it. There's a flow of stimulation that's pretty much, you know, we inhabit it in the environment, the external environment and the internal environment. So there's this flow of sensate experience, of stimulation. And that has a certain characteristic to it. Alongside that is a different kind of phenomena that is much more ephemeral, more transient than what happens in the body. In other words, the flow of mental process moves more quickly. Move is a funny word to use in this case, but basically the mind is moving at a much faster rate than what's going on in the body. It's the sense of cognitive awareness is what we call self-awareness. So there's a term, I talked about this a few weeks ago, contemporary psychological term called metacognition. And it's meta means hovering above, and cognition is thinking. So it's described as thinking about thinking, which is another way to describe mindfulness. But that also includes investigation. right? So, and it includes right effort. So those three functions of the brain are moving much more rapidly and are inherently insubstantial. You know, there's no there there. Thoughts are really mysterious in that regard. So one of the things that I'm doing in my practice these days is practicing mindfulness of breathing. And I've talked about this before in these recent talks, but I think I want to share with you my experience with the sensation of breathing as being the common point of reference. Then I move my attention systematically throughout my whole body to notice the subtle vibrations that are always there. The vibrations that you might notice when your hand goes to sleep or your leg goes to sleep. That's just an amplification of sensations that are there all the time. Part of being alive. Well, my discipline, my meditative training allows me to systematically develop a whole awareness of that vibratory body, along with breath awareness. That provides a kind of a substantial or a different experience than thoughts that are fleeting around, the periphery of that. So that's very useful in my practice for noticing nama rupa. So I think that's something to think about. And one of the things that we want to not just think about, but train for. One of the skills that we're trying to cultivate with this purification of view is to notice that how the mind develops a sensation has these different characteristics. For example, the basic practice of mindfulness of breathing is air moves in and out of the nostrils. It stimulates nerve endings, little hairs in the nostrils or temperature sensors in the nostrils are stimulated. That is rupa. It is just that. Then the mind interprets that. This is warm. This is cool. The air is moving in, the air is moving out, so forth and so on. Now, I'm going to add into that this whole body awareness that I described. Typically, I watch the sensation around the nostrils, and then I watch the sensations in the upper lip. And that vibration is there, and that kind of sets the stage for me to move that awareness all around my body. But that's also just physical stimulation. It's all it is. Along with that comes a perception. Perception of temperature change. The in-breath is pretty much always cooler than the out-breath because the gases that are in your body are warmer. So when you exhale, it stimulates the temperature nerves that regulate awareness of warmth. That's rupa, that's not nama. But then my mind imposes on that warm, cool. My mind also imposes on that vibration. Then the mind imposes an intention to expand that awareness, you know, around my body. That's also nama. So to be aware of that as the process is going on is what this Vipassana involves. And to be aware that the process is always changing. Always. It's changing subjectively in terms of the quality of attention that is brought to bear on whatever is being attended to. You know, my mind will be focused on the vibrations in the upper lip. Then my attention will lag, if you will, and be aware of some kind of thought process that's going on off to the side, so to speak. And then that will change because I'll bring my attention back to the sensation, the rupa aspect. Also, it might be that a sound occurs. That sound is just, it's rupa. But the mind will impose a distinction on that that separates it from whatever other kinds of ambient sounds might be in your environment. And maybe go further and distinguish that as a bird. And then go further and either say, ooh, I like that, or damn that bird. Right? So all of that is what we're trying to notice. Because you can see how that's fundamental to understanding impermanence and whether the mind is afflicted by craving and clinging. That makes sense? Right? So this process continues on. Another aspect of nama comes up, right? Effort that redirects attention back to the rupa part of it. But being aware of that, that's all awareness of nicca and awareness of dukkha as craving and clinging, and eventually a realization that there's nobody in there running the show. It's impersonal. All these transitory conditions are not being driven by any kind of identifiable autonomic and enduring ego. Very important distinction to make. But typically that distinction doesn't occur for a long way down the road, so to speak. Mostly impermanence and the onset of dukkha and the letting go of dukkha. That's what we notice. So that's purification of view. The next level is purification by overcoming doubt. This is basically cause and effect, or karma. You can be aware that, I just described it, I can notice that when the mind is not adequately balanced, the seven awakening factors are not adequately developed, there's a potential for craving and clinging. When the seven awakening factors are fully operative, there's no craving and clinging, there's no dukkha. There's still impermanence, there's still the absence of an enduring self, but dukkha is inoperative, conditionally. So, being able to notice that when attention is inadequate, not fully developed, that the effect of that, that's the cause, the effect of that is dukkha, craving and clinging. So you cultivate an awareness of how that operates on many levels. Sometimes it's something you're aware of in what's happening right now, but other times it can be an insight by recollection. Something happens and you kind of realize, oh, that's what that is. They call it the aha moment. You might read about it or hear about it, but then you actually have the subjective experience and you realize, oh, that came about because of this condition. One of the terms and concepts is papancha. And papancha is interpreted as proliferation. And, you know, what that means is that the mind jumps into story making or self-creating from a single stimulus. That's all it takes. Like I said, the sound hits the ear and the mind jumps on, that's a bird. Isn't that lovely? I'm not supposed to be doing this. Back to the breath. That's papancha, right? So being aware of that is an important part of this process. Now, it may not be that I'm immediately aware of it, but a few breaths down the line, I realize what happened just a few minutes ago was papancha. I get it. And then I'm more prepared to apply papancha in an ongoing way. Papancha is a great way to understand impermanence and craving and clinging, right? You can see that. And eventually that will lead to insight into the absence of an enduring autonomous self. Okay. So this level of practice starts to change the way energy flows in the whole system. When I say the whole system, I'm talking about the brain, I'm talking about the body, but also hormonal levels, adrenaline, so forth and so on. So that brings up the next stage, which is purification of knowledge and vision of what is path and not path. Last week, I was talking about the last two awakening factors, concentration and concentration slash unification of the mind, and equanimity slash balance. When I was doing that, I was talking about the jhanas, which is an exclusive quality of attention, but then also what are called the vipassana jhanas. Now, this is this particular part here, purification of knowledge and vision of what is path and not path. This is about the vipassana jhanas. One of the things that happens as the mind becomes more capable, more alert, the flow of energy is more efficient, it creates extraordinary states of mind. Colors might be more vivid, sounds might be more vivid, there might be these moments of awareness. I was talking to somebody just yesterday, my very first retreat at the Insight Meditation Society was 2 weeks long, and it was in late winter in 1982, and the trees were just beginning to put out shoots. So I was walking up a gravel road very mindfully. I was probably a week into the 2 weeks, and you know, I was a novice at this, right? But I was going up there, I was determined to, whatever they wanted me to do, I was going to do it to the best of my ability. So I'm hearing the crunch, crunch of my feet on the gravel and actually feeling the texture as the rocks kind of slide past each other under the soles of my feet. Very aware of that. And then there was a bird song. And I'm a southern boy. This is Massachusetts. I never heard this song before. It just struck me to the core. Now, I think in the Zen tradition, this would be called Satori. I'll never forget it. It was so vivid. I have no idea what the bird was. Doesn't matter. But the quality of awareness was extraordinarily beautiful, exhilarating, reinforcing, so forth and so on. One can become fascinated with that. This is one of the dangers of cultivating jhana states, which I did experience many years ago on retreat. For about 18 months, I was able to really cultivate jhanas, and it kind of dissipated. But there's a quality of blissful awareness that is extremely attractive and very, very pleasurable and very seductive. And this is the Vipassana jhana equivalent of that. I don't know. I described that experience on that first retreat, and I've had other experiences on retreats that were that brilliant. But nothing like the exaltation of the jhana states. So I don't know that the Vipassana jhana states are that dramatic as they are with the regular jhana states, but they certainly can be seductive. And a person can become stuck in that mode. Someone who's very competent at meditation practice, at vipassana, cultivates a really high level of samadhi paucity, seven awakening factors are moving right along, they can kind of go into cruise control. And it's a very pleasurable experience. It's worth it. It's good for you. Will do no harm. But it limits your ability to move further in the process of awakening. So that's what that vision of what is path and what is not path is about. So the suggestion with that is that you are aware of it. It's useful to have someone around who is knowledgeable about the danger of this and just basically kind of says to you, don't take it seriously. Don't make it personal. Keep looking closer. And those of you who have been on retreats with me, you've heard me say this multiple times on retreat. Something comes up, and what do I say? Look closer. Look closer. That's a basic way to keep this path developing. No matter what goes on, look closer. Because what you're really doing is you are strengthening the functioning of the seven awakening factors in their unification. It becomes very powerful. So, as that process goes further, the next stage can become apparent. Contemplation of rise and fall. Now, I mentioned how valuable, how important it is to cultivate awareness of anicca, of the transient nature of subjective experience. Well, it kind of moves into a very high level of awareness at this point. The mind is very agile. It's not burdened by craving and clinging. So you begin to notice something that is embedded in Buddhist psychology, which is the momentary arising and passing away of self states. I've talked about this many times. There's actually contemporary neuroscientific research that validates this. And these people figured this out, you know, thousands of years ago through direct experience, awareness. You notice thoughts coming and going. Coming and going, coming and going. Now, one of the things you can contemplate, and those of you who are going on this retreat, well, the next time you go on a retreat, you don't think about how quickly thoughts occur. One of the things they've been able to do with neuroscience is determine cognitively how frequently these bits of cognitive selfing occur. Multiple times a second. Next time you're deeply in Vipassana practice, don't pull out your watch and look at the second hand. That'll spoil it. But just contemplate when you think something, you don't really reference it to time, but it happens so fast. And when you get into that quality of dedicated but relaxed, insightful attention, you'll start to notice when the thought begins and then it goes away. Or almost like being able to read a sentence, but to be able to see each word rather than streaming them together. Right? That's what this is about. Contemplation of rise and fall. And you begin to realize, and I mentioned this when I was talking about my practice, that the thoughts are so ephemeral. It's going so fast. But you keep looking closer. And you keep maintaining that kind of alert curiosity, the joy awakening factor, along with investigation. And also involves stability of attention. Mind is not jiggly, so to speak. But you just notice that things pop, 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 pop. Come and go really fast. That leads to the next stage, contemplation dissolution. Now, I actually had this experience many years ago on a different retreat with Matt Flickstein, as a matter of fact, up in Gainesville. It seems like when you notice arising and passing away, you mostly notice the arising. You notice arising and passing away. But when you take it to the next level, All you notice is the passing away. And the way I've described it, it's like trying to walk on ice and you can't get traction. It feels like your feet are falling out from under you all the time. I heard Joseph Goldstein describe it as it felt like you were over the edge of a cliff. You didn't know how far down it was to the bottom, and you're hanging on by a branch, and you let go. And then there's another branch, and you let go, and you let go, and you just keep letting go. And all you notice is the letting go. That's the way he described it. So that's knowledge, contemplation of dissolution. It reminds me of one of my favorite poems. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold, their anarchy is loosed upon the world. That's what dissolution is about. It's scary, and that's the next one, contemplation of the fearful. When I had this experience, it lasted a very brief interval of time, a second, maybe 2 seconds. It scared me. My mind reacted to it as if I put my hand on a hot stove. Mm-hmm. My mind bounced back because it seemed like there was a realization that there's no self. That's what I realized. The only way I could compare that would be back in my psychedelic days when I would have these really profound psychedelic experiences, and it really didn't seem like anybody was running the show. The way I described it to people, it's like strapping yourself on a Harley and filling a tank with gas, turning it on, and you couldn't stop it till it ran out of gas. And it just kept, things kept happening and happening, and there wasn't anybody running the show. It was really transformative. Huh?
That's not bad, though.
Well, it could scare the hell out of somebody.
Okay.
But that's the idea, though. Once you understand this conceptually, should you have this experience with psychedelics or hopefully with the meditation, you realize, okay, that's what's going on. I really didn't know that at the time. It hasn't happened since. But I believe that the next time it happens, I'll be able to stay with that dissolution, right? That's the next level of practice. And it stops being fearful. And the next level is what's called the desire for deliverance. So what that means is that either the experience of things falling apart, impermanence, or the desperate need for there to be a self running the show, which is dukkha, and the third one, anatta, all of those, if you keep looking closer, you realize that the problem is not the dissolution, the problem is the holding on. The problem is the craving and clinging. That's what's going on here. We're so identified with the notion that there's a self running the show, an ego that needs to either be gratified or defended, mm-hmm. and can flip from one to the other in a heartbeat. To realize that and to be able to stay with that collapsing, not necessarily for, you know, weeks, although apparently in what I've read, it can be like that for people for quite a while. It doesn't have to happen very long. When I had that moment of dissolution awareness, it's what's called an insight by inference. I had done enough reading to realize, oh, this is what I've read about. This is the confirmation of that particular stage. So that didn't, you know, I couldn't, the conditions were not, the cause and effect clause was not operating sufficiently for that to be able to be re-experienced. But I know it's true. I know it's true. The same thing is true with this notion of deliverance. Once you realize directly, experientially, that the problem is not the dissolution, the problem is the grasping to the notion that there should be a self. Now, at this stage, we're talking about moving toward nirvana, right? Once you get to that stage, it's more and more subtle, and requires more and more mental acuity, more and more appropriate circumstances. Think about what I was talking about, all these other stages, beginning with virtue. All these things have to be just in the right place for the conditions to occur, cause and effect. Knowledge in reflecting contemplation. So there's... because of this awareness, there's the ability to know it directly, the aha moment. That's what reflecting contemplation is about. It's not something you reflect on afterwards, although that could be the case, but for this system to be really fully productive, it's something that you realize as it's happening, the metacognition part again. That you reflect, okay, this is the seven awakening factors are the cause, and the effect is a realization that this self is not real. Right? Remember I said, you start out being aware of impermanence, and you start out being aware of dukkha, then you become aware of impermanence, then you become aware of the how the two operate, but now we're getting to the stage where the whole notion of an enduring autonomous self starts to fall apart. So the next stage is knowledge of equanimity and adaptation of truth. Now, at this stage, it's sort of like a door is opened. An opportunity presents itself. In the literature, the commentaries, it says the door can either be through anicca or dukkha or anatta. What that means is the cause and effect process is operating in such a way that there's a realization of the transitory nature of cognition that is opens the door to the unconditioned. That's the door you go through. You can apply that same kind of protocol to the other ones. There's a quality of awareness about the futility of craving and clinging. The uncertainty, the inherent dissatisfaction of craving and clinging that opens the door. Or thirdly, as I just mentioned, there's a realization that there's no self. There's no self that's separate from causes, conditions, and there's no self that lasts. It comes and goes. That could be the door. So that's the adaptation to truth. And then purification of knowledge and vision. This is when the Noble Eightfold Path turns into the Noble Tenfold Path. You know, the wisdom aggregate in the Eightfold Path is right understanding and right intention. It changes. Right understanding matures, cause and effect, becomes right knowledge. You know it. And right intention becomes right liberation. It's just, you know, the thing about intention is one of the chittasikas. It's with us at every moment of consciousness. You cannot intend for nirvana to happen because it's impersonal, right? And intention is something that is personal, it's so to speak. I intend to experience nirvana. It doesn't work that way. The whole notion of intention dissolves along with the other factors, and that is the cause and effect. The conditions are ripe for right intention to become right liberation. And that opens the door to nirvana. So, when I first started practicing back in the early 80s, my assumption was that this experience of nirvana was something that was absolutely extraordinary. Very, very few people in the history of humanity had ever experienced it or ever will. I realize now that that was naive, that there are probably tens of thousands out of the billions of people on the planet today, maybe hundreds of thousands, who have experienced nirvana. I'm not one of them. Like I said before, if all I do is have a more integrated life and more kind and more generous and compassionate and all that, I'm good with that. But I'm really curious about where this could go.
Right?
I'm really curious about where this could go. So that's why I sit so much, sit twice a day. And that's why I typically go on 3 retreats a year.
Wow.
And that's something that I want to leave you with. The potential for nirvana is here. It's just like the potential for climbing Mount Everest, which far too many people are doing now, but just an example. You can't just decide, I'm going to climb Mount Everest. You have to train for it. Mm-hmm. In all kinds of ways. You have to have the right equipment, the right lifestyle, the right physical training, the right skills for whatever it takes to climb the cliffs and so forth, and the ice falls and all that, the right guides. But when all of that has been put into place, yeah, you can climb Mount Everest. Same thing is true with awakening. If you are willing to invest the time and effort into training the mind, studying, talking about it, going on retreats, you know, meditating on a regular basis, marvelous things can happen. But you have to decide it's worth it. And, you know, this life is precious. If I'm going to do something with it, this is what I want to do. Some people, you know, want to jump on a Harley and ride off into the sunset. No. I want to understand at the deepest level what it means to be alive, what it means to be human. That's what this is about. So, now the opportunity presents itself for people to ask questions, and I'll see if I can answer them. And welcome, Allie. I just talked to you yesterday. Nice to talk to you, dear.
Thank you. It's been very cool. I managed to hop in at like around 8:15.
Great, great. Okay, so questions or comments before we end the sitting tonight? Yes, speak loudly, please.
Okay.
David.
When you said that you've reached the point where you're where there's like liberation, can you elaborate on what you mean by that? Like
no.
Okay.
I can guess at it. I can tell
but
you.
I mean
literally what the whole notion of nirvana is, there are no conditions applied to it. None whatsoever. It's a profound state of mind.
Right.
Huh?
And there's no controlling it either. It's
right.
Happening spontaneously.
Causes and conditions.
Okay.
It's impersonal. Mm-hmm. That's the core understanding of this whole. Everything that happens to us is impersonal. That's what anatta is about. But okay. It's a miracle
mm-hmm.
that the
right.
impersonality of consciousness operates the way it does. It's mm-hmm. just, it's brilliant. Other questions or comments?
You mentioned the joy. It was what was the definition? The further
joy awakening factor.
It was like the ability to realize the value of everything. I don't know. I can't remember how you paraphrase. I'm paraphrasing it. I think it was joy. One, it was a real positive feeling, and then you.
I'll talk about PT. PITI. That's joy. If we're talking about jhanas, it's a quality of neurological excitement.
That was it. That's what it was, the excitement. You used that
yeah.
in the word, in the definition.
Right. It's very...
Like an excitement of the moment or whatever.
It's very pleasurable,
mm-hmm.
Very exhilarating, and very seductive.
Right.
Now, in the context of awakening factor, it's not that. It is, there's a quality of buoyancy and interest and resiliency in PT in terms of Vipassana practice. There have been times, and some of you have heard me talk about this before, I woke up one morning, I was meditating, got up and meditated, I get do that every morning, and started to have a pain in my lower abdomen. And I have experienced kidney stones several times in my life. And I realized, oh, this is a kidney stone event. So after I was done meditating, I got back in bed and I was laying there and it really got intense. But what was interesting about it was, back to joy and the awakening factors, I was able to have some equanimity about the intense pain. My body was writhing around. My mind was saying, isn't this interesting? Wow, look what a body does. Isn't this interesting? And I've had other medical experiences that had that same kind of heightened interest in something that was other people regard as scary and very, very painful.
Right. Cool, great, thank you.
All right. So, I want to say that PT is, we're born with it. I mean, we've all experienced being really interested in something. That's PT. You've experienced having the hairs go up and down on the back of your neck. Or feeling a surge of excitement when you are really inspired. That's PT. It's a condition of life. But this is the intentional cultivation of that condition. So, any other questions or comments? John? Okay, John and then Allie. Unmute yourself. No, you're muted, John.
How about now? Can you hear me now?
Can hear you now.
Okay. I just think that I'm a long-term meditator like yourself. I was a TMer for 20 years before I started Vipassana. I've been doing, you know, with you since 93, so add it all up, it's about 48 years. But for me, like, I went through the jhanas, and it's a change in perspective. In the first place, when you learn that you think in words, and then you start seeing a kind of life for what it is, I think it's all amazing. And that I think that if consistent sitting, you will get to a jhana, you will get to a stage where you don't think in words, where you're actually seeing what is going on for what it is. And I think that's the habit that you break, that you get the full spectrum of what this God-given mind can let you observe. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, and I'm gonna say something I've said to you before, John. I don't think that you have experienced jhanas. I think you have experienced Vipassana jhanas. You've heard me say before that you can very quickly and easily get to a place of stability and serenity and so forth and so on. And I tell you, you've fallen into cruise control. I tell you, keep looking, right? That's I want to say that again, because you are, one of my longest students, and I really want you to be able to put this to best use. It's, what you're practicing really is Vipassana. It's not jhana. Now, you can term it that way if you want, but it's the quality of your ability to investigate what's going on is what's important in terms of your ability to get to access concentration, which is samadhi paucity, stability of attention and tranquility of the mind. You can do that very, very easily, but you do it, it's very comfortable for you. And that's why I keep encouraging you to look closer. Okay?
Just what I'm trying to say is that the jhana is a stage that you're going to pass through. I I don't know what to call it, but it was, you know, 20 years ago when I did it. But since then, I just think it's very valuable to understand that when you observe life for what it is and not thinking in words and relating it to I, me, how will this affect me, that is the opening. Do you know what I'm saying? I don't know
yes.
what word to call it, but I think through consistent sitting, everybody will get those experiences, and that's all. That's all I'm going to say.
Yes, awesome. You're right.
Thanks.
Allie?
Okay. So I was wondering, how would you, or how did you, end up integrating that experience of that brief moment of dissolution? It sounds like it was quite profound, and it sounds like these states, when one is able to achieve them, are quite profound. So how did one end up integrating that into their view and understanding after it's already passed?
Well, that's the insight by inference. It built my confidence that this practice is valid. I think it would be interesting to have the experience again with more equanimity, more balance, to see what happens. So the integration was an understanding, a conceptual understanding, oh, this is one of the stages of insight. And the fear was the, you know, revulsion, the fear of dissolution. That's what that was. So that, at that point, it became workable. That's one of the values of the conceptual structure of Buddhism. These people kind of dove into the psyche at a very, very deep level, very, very sophisticated and subtle level, and discovered all these interesting things about how the selfing process operates. So we benefit from studying that and trying to put it into a context that's relevant to how we live our lives now without losing the beneficial aspects of the concept. And then try to have the aha moments that validate it. Let me say this too, that from what I've read, it is not necessary for me to experience that effect again. I could go right to the next level because the concept is understood. But it might happen again. But it's impersonal. It's about cause and effect. It's not necessarily me gritting my teeth and say, by golly, I'm going to make this happen.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, so there will not be a meeting next week because I'll be leading a one-week residential retreat at a retreat center called Deerhaven. And two of the people in this Zoom meeting and one of the people here in this room will be at that retreat, and myself. The week after that, the meeting will be dedicated to processing the experience of the retreat. This is something we've done after people have had significant retreats, either ones that we've all been on together or ones that any one person has been through. Because I think it's very useful for people to have a chance to think out loud about their experience, and because I think it can be informative and inspiring for those of us who are hearing it. So, having said that, let's sit for a moment. Thank you for your practice. I wish you well, and I hope that we're all reasonably safe and happy until the next time we have a chance to meet.